House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Thursday, February 16, 2012. First item on the agenda today is Senate Bill 1505. Mr. Taylor.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would refer you to Janet Noel, who's a staff person on this bill.
Good morning, committee. Senate Bill 1505 comes to you from the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy. It was voted out of the Senate Judiciary Committee with a unanimous vote, and it passed on the floor with 30 aye votes as well. This bill specifies new procedures for civil commitments of Native American individuals when the state does not have jurisdiction over the individual that is most likely a member of the Warm Springs tribe. It allows, under current Oregon law, those individuals, if they're civilly committed, are sent to the Oregon State Hospital. This bill would allow them to go to any appropriately licensed facility or hospital, which may bring the person closer to their home. It also requires the director of the hospital or facility or the attending physician to notify the tribe of all of the actions taken related to the commitment within 24 hours of the action taken. And it requires the community health mental program director to initiate an investigation of the commitment within 72 hours of admission to the hospital or facility. And the bill also specifies that this transportation to the facility is paid for by the tribe.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. And this is something, you know, I occasionally kick myself for not noticing things. And you will remember House Bill 2009, probably a moment in which we should have fixed this problem. But the current problem is that that will be corrected by Senate Bill 1505 is that Warm Springs members by state statute must be committed to the Oregon State Hospital. What we currently do, as Patty O'Sullivan of the Hospitals Association testified to Senate Judiciary Committee, what we currently do is at least temporarily have people committed to St. Charles Medical Center in Bend and hope that they will forget the statute and the people will not then end up at the state hospital. We would rather have the law reflect the better practice, which is keeping these mentally ill tribal members close to their homes. Now, this comes up because of federal law. There's a long history of the Warm Springs and then more recently the Burns Paiute Tribe reservations being beyond state jurisdiction, and the state legislative assembly saw fit to solve the problem that was caused by that of the inability to have a tribal court certainly commit someone by passing a statute in 1987 that set up a process. All this does is update that process so that Indians living on Warm Springs Reservation and Burns Paiute Reservation are treated like everybody else, and they have that opportunity to be committed to an OHA licensed facility. So it doesn't change any of the costs. The statute states that the tribe bears the cost of commitment, and that will stay the same. So none of that's changed by the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And
okay, any questions?
Representative Tomei. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, Michael. Thank you for bringing this bill to us.
You're
Michael,
welcome.
So if someone is committed to the hospital with the determination of guilty except for insanity, tell me about what happens then.
Well, that's a good question. I haven't been I haven't been engaged in those cases, but Co-Chair Barker, Representative Tomei. But my understanding is that, I mean, the way the law is now, they would have to be sent to the state hospital. That's where they would remain.
Follow up. So I just want to make sure I understand. So if somebody has a situation where they have to be picked up and taken to a hospital, so this bill says that they would go to St. Charles in Bend. But if a crime had been committed and they have to be examined to see if they are eligible to stand trial, able to stand trial, then would they go to the state hospital for that determination?
Well, again, Co-Chair Barker and Representative Tomei, this only deals with civil commitment, so I'm not, I don't think there's any change. I mean, this doesn't try to change that process.
Got it. Okay.
And if I may clarify for the committee, just to be clear, this only affects Indians living on the Warm Springs, Indians living on the Burns Piat Reservation, very small population there. It does not affect non-Indians. Any non-Indian there is still subject to the state law, so this isn't affecting them.
And it, my follow-up, it does say in here, I don't have the actual legislation in front of me, unfortunately, but it does say only for civil commitment. Am I correct in that? Or maybe staff?
Co-Chair Barker, oh, yeah.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, you're welcome. Representative Shoffman.
No, it begs the question, why don't we, I know we don't probably have the resources or the facilities or the ability, but why wouldn't we do this for everybody so they can stay closer to home? I mean, I'm not asking you to answer that question, Michael.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Anybody else want to testify?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1505 to the floor if they do pass.
Open a work session.
All right. I'd like to move Senate Bill 1505 to the floor if they do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 1505 to the floor if they do pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative
Wan? Aye.
Representative
Wisnett? Excused.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have some carry? Representative Wan, please, from the Interior. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1525.
Good morning, Chairs. Senate Bill 1525 comes to you today from the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee, and it was voted out of that committee unanimously and passed the Senate with a unanimous vote. It specifies that individuals who are employed full-time by tribal government as public safety officers who possess certain qualifications are eligible for certification and recertification through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. It also makes a change to the Board of the Public Safety Standards and Training membership and specifies that the member from the FBI is a non-voting member.
Thank you. Marilyn Rance, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee. My name is Marilyn LaRance. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Senate Bill 1525A makes two changes to our agency's statutes. One of them relates to our relationship with tribal law enforcement agencies, and one to a position on the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. I would like to briefly discuss the tribal certification matter first. For many years, since legislation was passed in 1971, our agency has had a relationship with Oregon's tribal law enforcement employers, and as part of that relationship, we provide training and certification to police, corrections, parole and probation officers, and 911 dispatchers who meet our minimum standards. Because the tribes are sovereigns, their public safety employers were not required to be under our jurisdiction, but most of them over the years have chosen to voluntarily comply with our standards. When Senate Bill 412 was passed last session, the voluntary nature of that relationship was changed for those tribes that chose to implement Senate Bill 412 and to have state peace officer authority for their tribal police officers. Under Senate Bill 412, tribes choosing to implement the bill are now required to follow all of our requirements and to have all of their police officers meet our standards, receive training, and become certified. The legislation changed our definitions to reflect that new requirement. The changes to our definitions were written very narrowly to reflect that the new mandate applied only to those tribes who chose to come under Senate Bill 412. But when we began working with the tribes to implement the legislation, an unanticipated consequence was identified. The changes made to our definition removed non-participating tribes from our jurisdiction entirely, which removed the historic certification relationship between our agency and any tribes not participating in Senate Bill 412 or that were still in the process of moving towards implementation. After this issue was identified, we contacted members of the legislature, all of the affected Oregon tribal law enforcement employers, and the Oregon sheriffs through the Oregon Sheriffs Association. They all confirmed their shared understanding that this was not an intended effect of the bill. Legislative members gave us permission to work with legislative council to craft a solution that would restore that historic relationship without making any changes to the legislation that was passed last session. Senate Bill 1525A reflects those changes, which were reviewed with tribal law enforcement representatives and with the Oregon State Sheriffs Association before they were incorporated on the Senate side into Senate Bill 1525A. In the interest of time, the Oregon State Sheriffs Association has asked that we confirm for the record that they have no opposition to Senate Bill 1525A. The second issue that is addressed in the bill that's before you was raised by the current FBI special agent in charge for Oregon. The person in this position holds a seat on our board and by virtue of that position also on our police policy committee. The individuals in this position play an important role in policy discussions regarding law enforcement in Oregon. The current special agent in charge has recently been given guidance that as a representative of the FBI, he should not be a voting member of bodies such as the board, which involves state licensing or certification decisions that affect state or local law enforcement officers. My written testimony has a copy of the letter that he provided to our director. The FBI concern relates primarily to the fact that there could be conflicts if the FBI was required to investigate those same individuals for possible violation of federal law. Based on that recent concern, we also requested the amendment language that's reflected in Senate Bill 1525A regarding making that position a non-voting one on our board. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Are there any questions from the committee? Well, thank you very much
thank
for your testimony. Is there any discussion on the bill? Close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 1525.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 1525A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 1525A to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion on that? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative
Shoffler? Aye.
Representative Lemay?
Aye.
Representative
Wan?
Aye.
Representative
Wisnet?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson, will you be our carrier, please?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, before we move on, I move we suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Wisnet to vote on Senate Bill 1505.
Is a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Wisnet to vote on Senate Bill 1505. Are there any objections? Hearing none. Representative Wisnet?
Yay.
Representative Wisnet votes yeah, aye. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1527.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1527 is a technical fix to a statute that defines strangulation. It replaces conviction with crime. It changes the language so that the crime of strangulation becomes a Class C felony if the person committing the crime of strangulation was previously convicted of assault or menacing, and the victim in the previous conviction is the same individual as the victim of the current crime. I believe that there is an amendment to this that's being passed out right now, and we have some people here who are going to speak to the amendment and explain what it is to you.
And how does this change the strangulation portion from current law?
It changes one word, the word conviction, to the word crime. And this is found in Section 4E, and it's at the end of the sentence, and it changes Right now, it reads that the person in the current conviction is the same as the person in the prior conviction. So it implies that the conviction has already happened. This changes it so that the conviction hasn't happened, the crime has occurred. That will aid prosecution.
Thank you very much for that explanation. Mr. French, Elizabeth Kushwa, and Ms. Meyer, please. Go to any ordinance to identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I'll give my testimony in two parts. Excuse me. The first piece is to the bill that you have in front of you, 1527, the A. Engross version. We believe this was a Scrivener's or a printer's error. This was not the intention. The concept here being that the person could not be the victim of the current conviction if it's they haven't been convicted of the crime yet. And so it just is the one-word fix. This was heard, worked, and passed out of Senate Judiciary in about 3 minutes and passed the Senate 30-0. The second piece of this bill is the A6 amendments, which you have in front of you. This addresses a very recent Multnomah County Court decision that said, in cases where the district attorney or the court elects to reduce an A or B misdemeanor to a violation, that those defendants are eligible for jury trial and court-appointed counsel. This stemmed out of the Occupy Portland movement. The way this happens is that because the punishment for an A or B misdemeanor is higher, it carries with it that level of a crime when it goes to a violation and everything else that would go with a crime, the jury trial, the court time, the rest of it. By capping reductions when the court chooses or the DA chooses to reduce it to a violation at the maximum amount for the violation, that punishment stays at the violation level and therefore does not attach that piece of the crime to it. I know that sounds complicated, and I have real attorneys here who will help me.
You go.
Thank you very much. Excuse me, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Chuck French. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this issue. I'm the special counsel to the Multnomah County District Attorney, Mike Schrunk. I've been a prosecutor for over 30 years. This is an issue which has been lurking in the background, I would say, for many years. What essentially has happened here is that the legislature has granted the district attorney's offices across the state the authority to reduce crimes, misdemeanor crimes, to violations. When they did that, when the legislature did that, however, the fine structure for misdemeanor crimes remained in place. In short, when we as a district attorney's office exercise our option to reduce a misdemeanor to a violation, the defendant is still liable for the same level of fine as he would have were we to have kept the case as a crime. The legal effect of that is to make, at least in Judge Albright's opinion, and we have every reason to believe, or we have significant reason to believe she's correct legally, it has the effect of making a violation appear to be just as punitive, at least as far as fines are concerned, as had it remained a crime. Because of that punitive nature, the defendant retains, at least in her opinion, a constitutional right to, among other things, have a court-appointed attorney and have a jury trial. The impact of that, should it hold, and again, we have reason to believe it would hold up, is that we in Multnomah County, for instance, we process about 13,000 misdemeanor crimes every year. We charge them. Approximately half of those are charged as violations. We have about 6,300 crimes that are violations, and probably two-thirds of those, a half to two-thirds of those, would now be eligible for court-appointed attorney and jury trials in a way that I don't believe the legislature intended when they gave the district attorney's office authority to reduce those crimes to violations. So the impact, I think, is significant. The impact is not only monetary in terms of court-appointed attorneys for thousands of defendants throughout the state, but also in the processing time of the court system, because now at Multnomah County, at least, we will probably add 3,000 to 4,000 cases to the normal misdemeanor flow, which means they will have repeated pretrial negotiations, repeated court appearances, and ultimately, if they fail to appear, warrants will be issued for their arrest. That will take up jail space and police time. So the potential costs are significant, and we don't believe it's necessarily appropriate. We do want to take people who don't deserve to have a criminal record and reduce their crimes to violations, put them into diversion courts, put them into treatment courts if that's possible. This will have a drastic impact on all those treatment courts that we would, you know, that we have the option, because we can reduce a crime to a violation to use now that are probably going to be impacted by this. So I won't take up a lot more of your time, but we do strongly support this, and it's odd to have a prosecutor come in and ask the legislature to reduce the potential punishment for a crime, but we're here to do that, or punishment for an offense. We're here to do that because we think not only is it the right thing to do, but it also is appropriate in this budget situation not to be increasing the cost of our court system.
I have a question, Mr. French. So in theory, they could be fined $6,200.
Yes.
In reality, how often does that happen?
Never.
Yeah.
You're not losing any income, at least in our county. I mean, there may be counties here that can collect $6,000, but not in Multnomah County.
That's kind of my point. Representative Krieger.
Under the misdemeanor, there was a jail time.
Pardon me?
Potential jail time was available as a misdemeanor, right?
Yes, Co-Chair.
For a violation, there isn't?
There is no jail time available for a violation.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony. I understand the issue and the need for this. I'm a little surprised this hasn't popped up before. Has this issue been hanging out there for a long time? Because it can't be the first time that it occurred to a defendant that they had a right to counsel based on the potential fine.
That's a very good question, Co-Chair Garrett. Yes, we are surprised that it has not come to this. This is a 1977 decision. There's a guy in our office, Wayne Pearson, who has conducted our misdemeanor affairs since 1972. Actually, he's in charge of our neighborhood prosecutors, community courts. He's tracked this issue very closely. We did have one other decision in our county where a local judge did rule that all the constitutional rights except a jury trial applied. So now Judge Albright has gone beyond that and has extended it to jury trial rights too. So it has come up, but I'm a little surprised, as is Mr. Pearson, a little surprised that this hasn't been more heavily litigated in the past.
Representative Schaffner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's really good to see and refreshing to see that the good-hearted, well-intended people of the occupied movement bringing common sense and effective and positive change to our state and community.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the case that Mr. French is referring to was Brown versus Multnomah County. And at that time, the legislature had enacted a law as it relates to driving under, in which it said your first offense would be treated as a violation. However, it had a very high fine, and it also said that your next offense would be, I think it was either a misdemeanor or a felony. It also had all the other indicia of criminal prosecution, and the court at that time said, basically, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Therefore, you had to appoint counsel. We've been going over this for years, and I always thought the two main elements of that case were the amount of the fine and the fact that the second time around you were being treated as a criminal penalty. Here, the way I look at it, the only element is the fine. There is no step here. You could have violation after violation, and it's still a violation. This whole area has very, very significant impact, not only as it relates to treatment, but also as it relates to our state defense budget. We and I'm assuming in the coming years, as the budget gets tighter and tighter, are going to have to look at more and more instances where misdemeanors are reduced to violations. Just a given. So this, as I said, this whole area has significant impact for the state.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Taylor?
Co-chairs, Mr. Taylor, we spoke to PDSC and OJD yesterday, as well as Councils NASB and Hendricks, and everyone was comfortable with this solution.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer, please.
Kiel Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, thank you. We support the Dash A6 amendment. Basically, all it does is it makes sure that if the legislature is calling it a duck, that it walks, talks, and quacks like one. So if it's going to be reduced to a violation and there's going to be reduced procedural rights in trying the violation, meaning only to the court, lower standard of proof, then make sure that it's only fined like a violation. And that's all the A6 does. It brings the fine amount down to what the violation would be, consistent with the procedural rights that are given to you in a violation trial. So we think it calibrates it appropriately, and we very much support the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 4 of the A6 amendments. Says that this change applies to elections made on or after the effective date of this bill. So this is only going to apply to cases that were, could you explain, cases that were reduced to violations after the effective date of this bill? And if that's so, what are we going to do to handle all the cases that have already been reduced?
Co-Vice Chair Hicks, it's a good question. I don't think it's a huge practical issue, because what we're dealing with in Multnomah County is a group of cases of which only a small portion have been litigated on this issue. We have, I think, 9 or 10 cases that will be affected. All right. These cases are generally prosecuted quite rapidly. A police officer arrests someone, books him in jail. The next day, the district attorney's office will make a decision of whether to reduce that to that misdemeanor to a violation. So we're talking about cases, you know, should this pass in this legislative session. We're talking about cases that will immediately begin to probably within a week or two, all those cases will be processed under this protocol. So essentially, our exposure to this problem exists for a couple weeks if things are, you know, if this is passed. It might be preferable from a fiscal stance to try to make it retroactive, but I'm not sure that that's an appropriate thing to do. Okay. It would just cause consternation amongst certain people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm very interested in the original bill. It certainly had a broad relating clause, which anything could be put in this. Strangulation has come before this committee in the past and several times. I feel very protective of the original bill, and my fear is that it's somewhere between now, it would go back for concurrence, am I correct? It would have to go back to the Senate. No. That somehow we're going to lose that original bill, which was a pretty simple, straightforward bill. Do we have any sense? Has anybody talked with anybody in the Senate?
I'm not sure my confidence level in the Senate's ability or in what the Senate does, but this is very important. And I would also hope that Multnomah County would consider, since these are going to go to juries and all that, that they go ahead and undo the, don't run them out as violations, go ahead and put them back in as misdemeanors, but that's a different question. I don't think this will have a problem passing with the amendment, but the amendment is vital. This will stop the courts in Oregon if this was allowed to proceed. The violations have no jail, no possibility of jail time. They don't compound, so you don't have one violation next time is a felony, and all those other things that were thought to be fixed. But, you know, the courts do what the courts do, and we abide by those rulings, and so this is a fix that I think the court's looking for, I would hope.
And I certainly don't disagree with that, but as I said, I feel very protective of the original legislation.
I will join you in working to see that the Senate passes it.
Co-chairs, Representative Tomei, I did have a conversation with Chair Prozanski yesterday. He totally understands this issue and is behind the fix. I'm sure Mr. Taylor has had similar conversations. Chair Prozanski is the only senator I've spoken to about this, but I assume that with his understanding, we can move this pretty easily.
Further
questions,
please?
Yeah, go ahead. Chair, there's a meeting at 10 o'clock, but Mr. Tedder is going to meet with legislative staff and the council. I want to attend that. I would prefer not to move this because we don't have the fiscal anyway, and we don't have permission to suspend the rules so we can move the whole thing at the same time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1527. We'll expect to have a work session on Monday. Next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 1575. Open a public hearing.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 1575 comes to you from Senator Prozanski, Representative Sheehan, Representative Widener, increases the penalty for disorderly conduct from a B to an A misdemeanor when a person commits disorderly conduct within 200 feet of real property of which a person knows a funeral is being conducted. Funeral service, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Wally Ordeman, Becky Strauss, and Gail Meyer.
Mr. Chair, none of the legislators come in to speak on this.
I don't see anybody here.
Do you want me to make some comments about the bill?
Would you like to do it from your seat here?
That would be fine. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, this committee's heard this the last three sessions. The good Representative Garrett worked hard on it last session. To be honest with you, I'm not sure what changes have been made. We're going to hear about those. The last time we heard it, remember, there has been a court ruling on this now, and we got into some definitions about demonstration or vote protests or things like that. So I'm hoping the committee will seriously consider this bill and see if we found a solution this session that we can pass it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please. And just remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Ordeman, and I'm a funeral director from Albany and the legislative chair for the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of any legislation that helps to preserve the dignity and respect of the tributes and ceremonies that we have for deceased Oregonians. Disruptions to funeral and memorial services not only rob grieving people of tranquil remembrances, but also distract mourners from what is really important in times of loss, and that's paying tribute and celebrating a life well lived. For any of us to have to tolerate distraction, during our time of paying tribute would be monumentally upsetting as well as impossible to forget. As a funeral director who has facilitated too many military funerals, and in speaking for the funeral directors in your communities who have done the same, I appreciate that Senate Bill 1575 dictates consequences for interruption of these tributes. Funerals are not the place to make a political statement, nor are they the place to push anyone's agenda. Funerals deserve protection as well as isolation from any organization's tactics, and I feel that respect and dignity should prevail in these situations. Your funeral directors, and more importantly, the people that they serve, want a deterrent to protests and disruptions while they grieve, and I believe Senate Bill 1575 provides that deterrent, and I strongly support its passage.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to just put a few comments on the record. As you know, Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution prohibits laws that restrict expression based on the content of that speech. If this statute is interpreted so broadly as it would implicate unpopular speech because of the message, its application will be found to be unconstitutional. In our view, Senate Bill 1575 as is should not be interpreted in that way, and we caution that a government actor could risk a lawsuit for damages, injunctive relief, if the statute is enforced in such a way. But we are neutral on the bill as it is, and just want to raise that concern as the committee contemplates the intent of the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer, please.
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We also are neutral. We just felt we would be remiss if we didn't point out to the committee what we think to be some weaknesses here. It's really not the additional language through the bill that poses our problem, because the new language is very clear. It's the existing language in the disorderly conduct statute that will pose the problem, particularly when you overlay potential speech issues on top of it. If you look at lines 6, 7, 8, 9, the disorderly conduct statute has all sorts of undefined words in there, and it's subject to a whole breadth of interpretations. And so it talks about public inconvenience and public annoyance and public alarm, but not that the defendant intended, but creates even a reckless risk of creating the inconvenience, the annoyance, and alarm. And our only concern is that if you tack on enhanced penalties for what could be demonstrative speech issues on top of a statute that has that inherent drafting weakness to it, it will be fodder for appellate argument. So we just point that out.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess almost for Mr. Taylor, I see we're also striking the language, congregates with other persons in a public place and refuses to comply with the lawful order of the police to disperse.
That's correct.
What is the history on that?
Chair, members, committee, that was found unconstitutional in 2004. I should have mentioned that's in the staff measure summary. We're taking it out because it's a trap for the unwary. Police officer who's not a constitutional scholar may say, gee, I can, you know, you're congregating and you were being disorderly, you were making noise unreasonably, and I've asked you to move on. You stop making the noise, now you have a constitutional right there. Well, I told you to get on. And that could cause problems for the police officer, particularly with a violation of constitutional rights. Okay. And so that's the reason that's coming out. I want to make clear this bill, the new language, ties into the current disorderly conduct statute. One of the more heavily litigated statutes in the ORSs, okay? So all these provisions have been heavily litigated. And I think it's pretty safe to say that the only time a constitutional issue would arise here, it would be in the application, not a facial issue, because this is not addressed at speech, it's addressed at conduct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Ordeman, if you had to estimate how many funerals have you and your ancestors been involved in over five generations?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and Representative Juan, 2 months ago we turned the corner and are celebrating our 100th year at our funeral home. I would have to very quickly do some math. Are you saying funerals overall?
Yes.
That number would be in the thousands.
Now, based on that experience, do you have an understanding about the way people typically behave at funerals over the course of that history?
Disruption to, thank Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, Representative Wand, disruptions at funerals certainly are the exception rather than the rule. Very few situations that I have come across has there been any disruption to services. Over the last 5 years, the threat of disruption to, in particular, military funerals that we would be conducting has provided provided us with some more thought on this and potential safeguards when we're setting up those funerals. I'm not sure if I answered your question or not.
Well, thank you, Coach. Actually, what I'm driving at is the families, the grieving families. And would you describe the families at funerals as being perhaps more emotional and more vulnerable than other average folks in society at other times in their lives?
Representative Juan, Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, absolutely. That moment when ceremony is taking place to celebrate a life, as is the case with any sort of loss, divorce, loss of a job, transition in people's lives, is one of the most traumatic times in somebody's life. That provides for vulnerability during that time. Again, I'm not sure that I have directly answered your question, but it is certainly, and everyone in this room has experienced loss of a loved one, and myself included, funeral directors are not immune to that. And we find ourselves as funeral directors very protective of the people that have put their trust in us.
One last question, Mr. Kocher. Thank you. Mr. Taylor, is it accurate to say that part of the public policy behind the disorderly conduct crime is to prevent as much as we can incidents of violence in society? Is that part of what we're talking about with that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if the member feels that that is the intent, that's the intent, but that would be, I think, an underlying basis of all our criminal laws.
Thank you.
I think if I go a bit step further, when we're talking about funerals, we're talking about unreasonable noise. What may be reasonable noise at noontime may not be reasonable at midnight. What may be reasonable at a football game may not be reasonable at a funeral.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Willamette National Cemeteries in my district and a stone throw from where I live, and I've seen countless funerals for our fallen heroes drive through there. And I have a bunch of pals that are Vietnam veterans, and they are fine, hard-working Americans. Many of them are retired now, and they enjoy riding motorcycles. And they ride in these processions whenever if they have the time and opportunity, because they take their status as being a veteran and defending this country very seriously. My nephew just got back from Iraq, and I'm grateful he's totally healthy. I know exactly how these folks are going to react. We are protecting the safety, health, and welfare of these insensitive, heinous freaks that would even consider disrupting something as important to these families. That they would even imagine it, think of it, is just totally insensitive and heinous. And oddly enough, cruel irony here is we are actually defending and protecting those people that would disrupt these services, safety, health, and welfare at this bill. It's in their best interest that we pass this bill. But I appreciate everything you're doing up there. Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ergman, so have you had this kind of disruption in all of those thousands of funerals that have been conducted by your funeral home?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and Representative Tomei, I have not personally presided or facilitated a funeral where we have had this kind of disruption.
A follow-up? So do you know personally of anybody in other funeral homes in Oregon that have had these kinds of disruptions?
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, and Representative Tomei, yes, I do know of funeral directors that have encountered protests on small and large scales.
Here in Oregon?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
Just in light of some of the things that have been said, I think it's important to make clear on the record that the purpose of this bill is not to target the content of any particular speech. And the reason why this bill will survive constitutional review is that it is content neutral. It is intended to apply to any type of disorderly conduct, whether politically motivated or not. That's my understanding of the intent of this bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Kocher. And I'll take it a step further as well, which is that my concern here is that we strengthen the disorderly conduct statute at times when folks are more likely than otherwise to engage in violence, in response to disorderly conduct. And what I've just heard from an expert with five generations of experience and 100 years in the funeral director industry is that when folks go to a funeral, they are more emotionally vulnerable than perhaps at any other time in their lives, which would mean that it is more likely in response to garden variety disorderly conduct that they may react with violence, which is damaging to society in general, is harmful to everybody involved, and creates an unreasonable, in my opinion, burden on society. So I'm very concerned not with the content but with the likelihood for violence surrounding funerals, and that's why I think we should be strengthening these penalties in a very content-neutral way.
Thank you. I'd like to have that intent put on the record. Thank you. Is there any further questions? Thank you, panel. Move to a work session on Senate Bill 1575.
Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1575 to the floor if they do pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill, Senate Bill 1575 to the floor if they do pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative LeMay?
Aye.
Representative Wand?
Aye.
Representative Wisnitz?
Aye.
Co-Vice-Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice-Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. I think we'll ask Representative Sheehan and Widener to be the carriers on that bill. Is that okay?
Well, there goes the record again.
No further business before the committee. Adjourn.
10 o'clock. Yeah. We're really trying to do.
You're going to end up being our way.